Today I want to cover the ninth commandment. And if so, if you want a title, you can put the ninth commandment. I'm going to subtitle this, How to Deal with False Accusations. The ninth commandment is in the list of Ten Commandments called the Decalogue, and it's found in Exodus 20 and in verse 16. And in the King James, it says, Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. It's repeated in Deuteronomy 5 and verse 20. Neither shall you bear false witness against your neighbor. In modern day law, perjury is a felony that could result in up to 5 years in prison. Many years ago in law school, I recall a contracts professor who would come into the classroom every day, and he would take a piece of chalk, and of course that tells you it was a long time ago because they don't use chalk so much anymore, and he would take a piece of chalk and he would go up without saying a word, and on the chalkboard he would write two words, lying contest equals trial. In other words, anytime there was a trial, it was a matter of who was going to tell the biggest whopper. And, of course, lies are just part of society. It seems that they're everywhere. Unfortunately, we catch ourselves lying to ourselves, or people can lie to others about others, or lying to God. When other people do it, it's particularly painful because we can feel the impact. We don't like it when people lie about us because it affects our personal reputation. Or perhaps they lie about what we do and affects our professional reputation and slandering us. They may lie about our family to try to reduce us in the eyes of others. Or they may lie about our belief system because of their own inferiority complex. Because they can't defend their own belief system, they want to lie about ours. Or perhaps people lie about others to gain an advantage, whether it's in a divorce or in a contract dispute, perhaps a tort, a civil a legal issue or a crime. And some people lie without a purpose or a cause just because it's a habit. They tell a lie when the truth would better serve them. We call those pathological liars. It's interesting, a number of years ago, a British newspaper in the News Telegraph reported a number of situations about lies that were becoming rampant in society. And we may recognize them, although we don't always recognize them as lies. And it says there's, and this particular one is about false accusations of child abuse. It says, evidence is growing of disturbing flaws in the way allegations of child abuse are made and then pursued. And they go on to describe the investigation. And they talk about three things. That there's a growing body of concerned lawyers, doctors, and parents that there are not isolated cases, but a symptomatic lies of a legal and medical system so determined to protect children that it fails to protect the innocent. Well, what are they talking about? There were three women that were accused of infanticide, killing their own children. As it turns out, the prosecutors relied upon evidence from leading experts who decided, based on probability, that the mothers must have murdered their own children. The three diagnoses, first of all, was a shaken baby syndrome, and next was a Munchausen syndrome by proxy, and third was a recovered memories issue. Accounts for hundreds of other wrongful convictions of innocent parents over the last 20 or 30 years. What those convictions meant is that they were based on flawed opinions rather than forensic science or evidence. And too many doctors were then embracing pseudo-explanations for things that they really didn't understand. Because there was no obvious reason why the mothers should have lost more than one child, therefore they must have smothered them, and so forth. Because it was on the law of probabilities, this would be an issue. The most common false allegation, according to this news article from Britain, is shaken baby syndrome, because the characteristic signs for that, when they're present, such as bleeding in the eyes, known as a retinal hemorrhage. And yet science has shown that any number of reasons can cause that. Next was Munchausen's syndrome by proxy, a diagnosis first described in England, who claimed that some mothers seek the attention of doctors by then hurting their own children. And that's been invoked, this Munchausen syndrome by proxy, to explain over 100 of such pattern type of illnesses, including epilepsy, abdominal pain, bleeding, diarrhea, fevers, and lethargy, and so on. And the third type of false allegations against these mothers was about recovered memories of childhood abuse. And so, therefore, there must be a cause for this. And so, lacking any obvious cause, then the parents are swept into a legal nightmare against the professional psychologists who then draft up or claim that there must be a cause because that must be terrible. And so, ultimately, in this particular story, all of the mothers were cleared, ultimately, of the deaths of their own children. So we have a system, not just in our lives, but in the world, where just because they can, some people find it helpful or necessary for their own purposes to not tell the truth. You wonder, what does this false accuser accomplish? Well, we know that some people lie to gain some sort of advantage to save themselves from some embarrassment or call undue attention to themselves. And some false accusers do so out of a misguided sense of responsibility. And that sense of misguided responsibility will warp common sense. I saw a sign at a middle school wall. The poster on the wall said, "The person who angers you controls you." So, who pushes your buttons? Who seeks to anger you? Who seeks to set you up for failure in relationships with others? Well, of course, false accusations then usually cause most of us to, and then fill in the blank, pushing a hot button when somebody makes a false accusation. So, false accusers exist, but where do they come from? So let's go to Matthew 15 in verse 19. In Matthew 15, where do false accusers come from? In Matthew 15:19, "For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts," and then there's a couple of words, "false witness," and then blasphemies. So we can see that comes out of the heart of man. In Jeremiah 17:9, we read something similar. In Jeremiah 17:9, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" So twice we've been informed that this can come from the heart of man. But we must ask ourselves, who is the ultimate accuser? Who has an interest in seeing you fail? Who is jealous before the God of the hope of your destiny? If we turn to the book of John, in John 8:44, we can read the answer to that of who is the ultimate accuser. In John 8:44, "You are of your father the devil, and the lusts of your father you will do. He was a murderer from the beginning and abode not in the truth, because there's no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks of his own, for he's a liar and the father of it." So now we know who the father of lies is, the ultimate accuser, the ultimate liar. And yet, each of us has hope and opportunity to become a member of God's family. And Satan, the devil, hates that. He hates it that he's going to be displaced and does everything in his power to frustrate mankind with each person's relationship with each other and each person's relationship with God. So indeed, throughout history, there have been people who have distinctly and infamously violated then the ninth commandment. Let's turn to Genesis 37. In Genesis 37, and I'm going to start in verse 19. And this is the story about Joseph. Joseph, the son of Jacob, one of the many sons of Jacob. And when he was a young man, in Genesis 37, starting in verse 19, His brothers, of course, were quite jealous of him and the relationship he had with his father. And they saw him coming. And so in verse 19, and they said to one another, the brothers of Joseph, and they said to one another, behold, this dreamer comes. Come now, therefore, let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say, some evil beast has devoured him, and we'll see what will become of his dreams. Well, they were conspiring to lie. His own brothers were going to put a stop to the relationship that they thought that Joseph had with the father, and they were going to put an end to his dreams. Let's go down to verse 31, because of course they did go on, threw him in the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt. So let's turn to verse 31. And they, meaning the brothers, took Joseph's coat and killed a kid of goats and dipped the coat in blood. And they sent the coat of many colors, the coat of, that was identified belonging to Joseph, and they brought it, the coat, to their father and said, this we have found. That was a lie. Now we know whether it be your son's coat, or know now whether it be your son's coat or no. In other words, they were suggesting, we just found this bloody coat, and now you'll have to decide, is this really Joseph's coat? After all, you made it. This is so they conspired to lie, and then they actually compounded their lies. The father was devastated, rent his clothes, put sackcloth, and mourned his son for many days because they were so convincing in their lies that the father was greatly, greatly disturbed, and Jacob was greatly disturbed. Well, what happened to Joseph then? Let's take a look in Genesis chapter 39. We'll just turn a couple of chapters down. We'll start in verse 7, because Joseph was packed off on a caravan to Egypt, and he was sold to a fellow named Potiphar, and he was made a servant in Potiphar's house. In Genesis 39, and starting in verse 7. And it came to pass that the master's wife, Potiphar, cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, my master wanteth not what is with me in the house, and he commits all that he has to my hand. There is none greater in this house than I. In other words, he was given a lot of responsibility. Neither has he kept back anything from me, because you are his wife, then how can I do this wickedness and sin against God? Moving on verse 10. And it came to pass, as she, meaning Potiphar's wife, spoke to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not to her, to lie by her, or to be with her. And it came to pass about this time that Joseph went into the house to do his business. And there were none of the men in the house, there within. He was doing his job, performing for his boss, Potiphar. And verse 13, she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And he left his garment in his hand and fled and got out. So he got out. He didn't want to deal with the woman anymore, but she had his coat. And verse 13, and when it came to pass, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth, and she called unto the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, see, he's brought in a Hebrew to mock us, meaning her husband, and mock us. And he came in to me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. So she's claiming that she was the one who was being attacked, and that when she cried with a loud voice, suggesting that's when Joseph ran off. If we carry on, verse 15, and it came to pass when he heard, Joseph heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And she laid up his garment by her until his lord, the master Potiphar, came home. And she spoke unto him according to these words, saying, the Hebrew servant which you have brought unto us came in unto me to mock me. And it came to pass, as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment with me and fled out. And it came to pass, when his master heard the voice, words of his wife, which he spoke to him, saying, after this manner did your servant do to me, that his wrath was kindled Well, of course, Potiphar would be angry if someone tried to attack his wife. And verse 20, and Joseph's master, Potiphar, put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in the prison. How would you feel? You've been cast into a pit by your brothers. You've been sold by them, by your brothers. Your father doesn't know where you're at. You don't even know that the brothers have lied to your father, saying that you were dead by killing a goat, having conspired to do even more, and to carry on the lie for the next 20 plus years. And now he's being faithful yet again in Potiphar's house and doing his best to resist. And yet the lies were perpetrated against him, and he's in prison. Now, lest you misunderstand the nature of prison, there was no cable TV. There was no foam pad on the bench to sleep on. He did not get 3 squares a day. He didn't get out into the exercise yard to be able to pal around with the prison buddies. The diet, I presume, was rather miserable. And the company, even less desirable. And he was suffering by the lies of others. Let's take a look now in 1 Kings, with a look at just a few more examples. In 1 Kings, in chapter 21, we can read about Ahab and Jezebel, a couple of very nefarious characters in 1 Kings 21. And we're going to start in verse 1. About Ahab and Jezebel. And Ahab was a king of the northern tribes of Israel. I'm going to read this in the New International Version. Sometime later, there was an incident involving a vineyard belonging to Naboth the Jezreelite. The vineyard was in Jezreel, close to the palace of Ahab, the king of Samaria. Ahab said to Naboth, "Let me have your vineyard to use for a vegetable garden. Since it's close to my palace, in exchange I'll give you a better vineyard, or if you prefer, I'll pay you whatever it's worth." But Naboth replied, "The Lord forbid I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." So Ahab went home sullen and angry because Naboth the Jezreelite had said, "I will not give you your inheritance of my fathers." He, Ahab, lay on his bed sulking and refused to eat. Verse 5, his wife Jezebel came to him and asked, "Why are you so sullen? Why won't you eat?" And he answered to her, "Because I said to Naboth, 'Sell me your vineyard, or if you prefer, I will give you another in its place.' But he said, 'I will not give you my vineyard.'" Notice now in verse 7 what Jezebel's solution is. Jezebel's, his wife, said, "Is this how you act as king over Israel? Get up and eat. Cheer up. I'll get you that vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." And now what proceeds to happen is an elaborate series of lies set up against a man who owned his own vegetable garden. Now, I've got a vegetable garden. It's 16 feet by 16 feet. And I have a little spot where I put some melons. It's in an old hay bale feeder. And that's about, 8 feet in diameter. Great little spot, well protected. I'm hoping that nobody will lie and want to kill me for my little garden. So I suspect that Naboth's vineyard was more desirable than the one that I have, because obviously the grapes don't grow in one season. So if he had a vineyard and a vegetable garden, it required a lot of care because people survived on that. That's what they lived on. They didn't have Harps or Walmart or neighborhood markets to run down and fill up their carts. That was their life. And that was their dream and their hope. And many people put their all into that. And so Naboth wasn't willing to give it up. Further, he said it was his ancestors. It was a family plot. I know the family farm has been in my family's name since the 1800s. And we aren't just going to give it up because somebody else has a desire for it. Price isn't the issue. It's a matter of heritage. So what happens now to Naboth when Jezebel digs in her heels and decides what to do? Verse 8, she wrote letters in Ahab's name, placed a seal on them, and sent them to the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city. In those letters she wrote, "Proclaim a day of fasting and seat Naboth in a prominent place among the people. but seat two scoundrels opposite him and have them testify that he cursed both God and king, and then take him out and stone him to death. Well, it wasn't enough to just privately dispose of Naboth. It was Jezebel's idea to make him a public celebration, to say what a fine person he is. Bring everybody together for this celebration. A nice big public place. And then have what? A couple of scoundrels. Well, that's the word in the NIV for scoundrels. Of course, it would be easier to say liars. In the King James, it says, to bear witness against him and claim that he blasphemed God and the king. And, of course, calling then for him to be stoned. Well, of course, that got carried out. If we take a look then in verse 19, indeed, that's what was happened. Naboth died, and Jezebel says, well, he's dead. The vineyard is yours. Just go take it. Nobody's going to stop you now. And so now we have this terrible incident of false witnesses, of another false witness, actually a combination of them. The false witnesses have been with us throughout history, even, and we'll have them even to the very end. If we look in 2 Timothy 3, verse 1, in 2 Timothy 3, verse 1, this know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. And then it gives a list of what people will be like. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, and you think it can't get worse, right? Verse 3, without natural affection, truce breakers, and then those two words, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good. So it isn't enough to just lie, but they have to despise or lie about those who are good, who don't do those other things. John the Baptist was preaching prior to the ministry of Jesus Christ. And we read about that in Luke 3, starting in verse 3. In Luke 3, in verse 3, and John the Baptist is speaking of him, and he came into all the country about Jordan, preaching the baptism of the repentance for the remission of sins. Now down to verse 8. And he said, bring forth fruits worthy of repentance. And verse 10, and the people asked him, saying, what shall we do then? And interestingly enough, during all of this, and now we come to verse 12, then came also publicans to be baptized, and said unto him, Master, what shall we do? Well, publicans, of course, were not popular people. They weren't known for telling the truth. Look at verse 8 or verse 14. And soldiers likewise demanded of him, saying, and what shall we do? And he said to them, do no violence, neither accuse anybody falsely, and be content with your wages. So we have two sorts of people that were unseemly, that weren't respected because they were known to be liars. You see, John the Baptist told soldiers specifically they must not accuse people falsely. Soldiers, by the very nature of their job, Roman soldiers, were in a position of power and authority. They could make false accusations against someone, and that someone had little or no recourse. They would simply be hauled away, separated from their families. Perhaps the accused person's possessions and property would be seized. Maybe they were tortured, or even their lives lost. The Roman government didn't necessarily recognize the same due process of laws applying to the captive peoples, and the people in that area were captive peoples. Not very many of them were Roman citizens. There was no expectation of a court hearing, especially among the occupied peoples. Similar to the Roman soldiers, the government tax collectors were in a position of power and authority. They could seize people's money or belongings by making false accusations of money that was owed to the government. Zacchaeus was a tax collector in the time of Christ, during Jesus Christ's 3.5-year ministry. And notice what Zacchaeus The tax collector said directly to Christ. We find his comments in Luke 19, in verse 8. In Luke 19, in verse 8. And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold." Apparently, it was not uncommon for a tax collector to take more than he should have from the people. And tax collectors may have had a reputation for overreaching or outright graft and corruption. Well, today we know how sensitive people can be about the IRS extracting money for their income taxes. Some years ago, I know there was a sign in an IRS office, and the sign simply said, "Seizure fever, catch it." Only after the evidence of the sign was publicized, then the sign was taken down. Well, just as in the days of Zacchaeus about 2,000 years ago, so is the reputation of tax collectors today, their willingness to lie. The false accusers seem to be everywhere. Well, what about the ones at work, the ones that we have to run into? Do you have to deal with someone who's undercutting you behind your back? Are they minimizing your accomplishments or maximizing your mistakes? Are other people putting stumbling blocks in your path to make life difficult for you? The Bible recounts a particular example of how schemers plotted to kill a prophet of God. We can turn to Daniel in chapter 6 and verse 1. In Daniel 6 and verse 1, how schemers plotted to kill a prophet of God. Starting in verse 1 of Daniel 6, "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom." So he was an organized emperor, wanting to administer his government well. "And over these," meaning over these princes, the 120, "he set three presidents, of whom Daniel was the first, and the princes might give accounts to them, and that the king should have no damage." In other words, there was a hierarchy. The emperor, or the king, had three presidents who presided over 120 princes. And so that was the organization of Darius's government. Verse 3, "And then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm." We heard that sermon about Daniel's excellent spirit on Pentecost. And verse 4, "Then the presidents and princes sought to find accusation against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but could find no accusation or fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him." "Then said these men, 'We shall not find any accusation against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God.'" In other words, Daniel was so faithful, they just couldn't find anything. But because they didn't share Daniel's religion, they had hoped to make him stumble. "Then said these men," or verse 17, "and a stone was brought up and laid on the mouth." Am I wandering off here? Oh, yes. So at that point, after verse 5, they set up an accusation against David or against Daniel, that he was violating the king's law, and therefore by the king's law he would be thrown into the lion's den. So if we take down to verse 17, Daniel was thrown into the lion's den, and what happens? Verse 17, "And a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, and the purpose might not be changed according to Daniel." In other words, nobody could let him out. It was sealed. It was a wax seal put on the stone. And so Daniel was stuck in there with the lions. In verse 18, "And the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were there instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him." Well, obviously, the king thought that Daniel was his best servant, and indeed he was. So the king was sickened about all of this and lost sleep because he knew what happened to people that were thrown in the lion's den. This was likely not the first one. After all, there was a den where they kept lions. And the king rose, verse 19, the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of the lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamentable voice to Daniel. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, O Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, is your God whom you serve able to deliver you from the lions? And said Daniel to the king, O king, live forever. This was a standard honorable greeting to the king. My God has sent his angel and has shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me. Forasmuch as before him innocency was found in me, and also before you, O king, have I done no hurt. And then let's read on what happens. Then the king was exceeding glad for him, and commanded they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner was hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God. That would be difficult to imagine having that much faith. And that's why it's recorded for our benefit. And yet that was afforded that protection to Daniel. Verse 24, and the king commanded, and they brought forth the men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, but not just them, their children and their wives. And the lions had the mastery of them and broke all their bones in pieces ever they came out of the bottom of the den. So Daniel's accusers and their families suffered the fate they had intended for Daniel. Let's turn to Proverbs 26, verse 27, and we'll read a general principle of what happens when false accusers step up and make their accusations. In Proverbs 26, verse 27, he who digs a pit will fall in it, and he who rolls a stone, that stone will roll back on him. I know from time to time, being as human as everyone else, if somebody does me wrong, I get that little flash of thought that, well, I know what I'd sure like to do to that character if I'd given the chance. And then that Proverbs 26:27 comes to mind. And I think, do I want that to happen to me? Do I want that stone to roll back on me? Or do I want to dig a pit for someone else, and do I want to fall then in my own pit? And that's just what happened to the men that accused Daniel. They had Daniel cast into the pit, and into that same pit they went, but not just themselves, their entire families. In other words, their heritage was blotted out, because if they were lying and teaching lies, it is likely that that would have perpetuated in that family. There are other instructions that we read about in the Bible in Deuteronomy 19. In Deuteronomy 19, starting in verse 15 through 19. One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity, for any sin, or any sin that he sins, but at the mouth of two witnesses, or the mouth of three, shall the matter be established. Verse 16, if a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Eternal, before the priests and the judges, which shall be in those days. Verse 18, and the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witnesses be false witnesses, and have testified falsely against his brother, then shall you do to him as he thought to have done to his brother, so shall you put evil away from among you. Well, perhaps unjust accusations against you in the workplace don't result in you being thrown into the lions, as the prophet Daniel was. But I suspect that each of us have felt from time to time that the lions were gnawing on our bones once in a while. Well, what about the false accuser at school? Do you know what? Someone who's constantly trying to have to defend themselves. I've seen students falsely accuse each other. I've seen students quite willing to let someone else get wrongfully punished while they remain silent to avoid the punishment that they themselves richly deserve. I also know a teacher from many years ago who was falsely accused by a couple of students. And despite a clean history and a lifetime of teaching and dozens of positive character references, he was convicted on the false testimony of two girls and spent years in prison. Years later, the girls did recant, but by then the teacher had lost his job, his family, his reputation, and served years in prison. He even had a piece of his skin bitten off in prison as a constant personal reminder of the experience. Perhaps there's a false accuser among people that you know. The Apostle Paul wrote to Titus about the characteristics for bishops or elders. He listed characteristics that are expected of older men, older women, younger men, and younger women. That pretty well covers the range. Specifically, Paul exhorted older women to have certain traits. In Titus 2 and verse 3, the aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becomes holiness, not false accusers, not given to too much wine, teachers of good things. Interesting that he put in that term, not false accusers, because it's often a temptation, because as we get older, we gain wisdom, and we can see things before they happen, or we can project things that can happen. And we have to be careful when we're projecting ahead that something bad will happen when it may not necessarily, or putting a false thought into somebody's mind. I want to now go over 7 points. I call them solutions of what we can do if, in fact, we have to deal with false accusations ourselves. I'd like you to turn to Hebrews 12 and verse 11. First point on the solution side is to be prepared to be patient with those who sin against you. Be prepared to be patient with those who sin against you. Because, you see, being falsely accused is a painful process. In Hebrews 12, verse 11, no chastening. Now, no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterwards it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Being unjustly accused is a cruel and sad thing, but there's hope, and that hope calls for patience. Certainly in the case of Daniel, he needed to continue to call on God. He didn't throw up his hands and say, well, this is it. I'm breakfast or supper for the lions. And in each of those examples, it requires people to have patience. In 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, in 1 Corinthians 10, 13, it's hard to be patient, but it's a requirement of us. 1 Corinthians 10, 13, there has no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that which you are able, but will with the temptation make a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it. Sometimes the temptation is terrible. You want to do something yourself, man. Indeed, sometimes you do have to take action, but you don't have to sin. We're especially to be patient with those who are closest to us. They're the ones that we spend the most time with, whether it's family or friends or neighbors. In Matthew 18 and verse 21, we learn the lesson about being patient with those who are close to us. In Matthew 18 and verse 21, then came Peter to him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Till 7 times? Peter thought that sounded pretty liberal. I mean, that's quite a few. 7 times is, I mean, if somebody does the same thing to you over and over again, I can get pretty sore, can get pretty raw. Verse 22, and Jesus said to him, I say not to you until 7 times, but until 70 times 7. You notice that the verse, back in verse 21, was referring to brethren. These are the people whom you would not expect an offense to rise, meaning between and among ourselves. Yet we are to be particularly patient with the church brethren. This doesn't mean that we have to tolerate evil in our midst, but it takes time and work to overcome false accusations. Matthew 18 says how we're to treat someone who will not listen to admonition, and we treat them as an unconverted person. We continue on in Matthew 18 and verse 15. Moreover, if your brother shall trespass against you, and go and tell him his fault between you and him alone, if he shall hear you, and as you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear you, then take with you one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. Verse 17. And if he shall neglect to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he neglect to hear the church, let him be to you as a heathen man and a publican. It doesn't say you should shoot him. It doesn't say you should hang him. It doesn't say that you should tell lies about him to get him back. It doesn't say that you should injure him. It says you should treat him as a heathen and a publican. Well, then they ask the question, how do we treat someone who's a heathen and a publican? I mean, if you have a heathen or a publican walking down the street, well, we should look then to the Bible. How do we guide us in how to interact with all people? We have the principle of loving your neighbor and doing no harm to him. And 1 Corinthians 13 is a renowned chapter on love, on how we treat other people. So we can review that on how we treat the heathen and the publican or the tax collector. And of course, if they're going to do us harm, we probably don't want to hang around them very much. How many of us go down and have lunch at the IRS office with our Social Security numbers taped to our forehead? Saying, you know, we just don't challenge those kind of things. We just don't associate. So number two, that brings us to point two, do not associate with evil. Number point two is do not associate with evil. In 2 Timothy 3 in verse 1, this know also that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. We've gone over this. Without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, and so forth. And it keeps on going. Down to verse 5. Having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Notice these last four words. From such, turn away. In other words, don't associate with evil. Don't put yourself close to it. That's not going to help you. It's only going to get you in trouble. There's an old proverb that if you lie down with dogs, you will wake up with fleas. And that's what we're talking about here, is the proverb comes from this, is that we don't want to associate with evil. And turning away from evil is a critical step. Consider the example of Lot, and let's turn to Genesis 13. In Genesis 13, of course, Lot was the nephew of Abraham, and they had traveled to the land of Canaan, where God had given Abraham the land. And if we turn to Genesis 13, and we'll start in verse 7, and at this point, the Abraham and Lot had all of their property adjoining to each other. So Abraham had his servants and his livestock, and Lot had his servants and his livestock. And, of course, problems arose. Verse 7, and quarreling arose between Abraham's herdsmen and the herdsmen of Lot. The Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land at the time. Verse 8, so Abraham said to Lot, let's not have any quarrels between you and me, or between your herdsmen and mine, for we are brothers. In other words, they're family. Is it not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. In other words, Abraham said, you take your pick. If you want one way, I'll take the other. It's okay with me. We just don't want to fight. It's not worth it. We're family. Our herdsmen don't need to be quarreling. We don't need this trouble. We need to live basically in a more godly manner. And verse 10, Lot looked up and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, toward Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east, and the two men parted company. Abraham lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Verse 13, now the men of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. Lot set himself up to be too close to evil. He chose what he thought was the lush, rich area that was watered by the Jordan River. But it only set himself up for trouble later, because he chose poorly. He did not. He chose, and as we can read on, that Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. He chose poorly because he associated too closely with evil. About 30 years ago, there was a fellow named Robert Ringer who wrote a best-selling book entitled Looking Out for Number One. Maybe some of you might have heard of it. He wrote several other books. It was a self-help advice book, and Mr. Ringer had sold millions of copies of his book. One of the principles that went over so well, he listed his main principles on how to look out for yourself, looking out for number one. And he said, one of the principles was to, quote, eliminate drain people from your life, end quote. In other words, in biblical language, from such, turn away. Mr. Ringer made millions of dollars by rephrasing scripture. Scripture that is available to us at no cost. So if you want to keep yourself from being entangled with evildoers, turn away from them. This doesn't mean you shun other people, but you need not place yourself in harm's way. Point three, on a solution for how to deal with false accusers. Give no opportunity for others to accuse you. Give no opportunity for others to accuse you. In Isaiah 1, in verse 16, in Isaiah 1, verse 16, we're given the instruction of what we should be doing. And we do this at baptism, and we do this each year at Passover, and as often as we come before God. Isaiah 1 and verse 16, wash you, make you clean, put away the evil of your doings from before my eyes, cease to do evil. In other words, we are to clean ourselves up. Don't give an opportunity for others to accuse us, and we do that by making sure that our behavior is above reproach. In Philippians, in chapter 2 and verse 15, there's an interesting verse that mirrors what this is, and we heard this recently in a sermonette by Mr. Jackson. In Philippians 2:15, that you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. That's what we're to be, is to be blameless and harmless, without the sons of God, without rebuke. We know that we're in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation among the peoples of this world, and that's why we're called to be lights. Of course, it's very hard to be blameless and harmless, but that's our job. It's often said that the best cure is prevention. Or put another way, we've heard an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And one of the best ways to prevent a false accusation is to live our lives in such a way is to give our is to give no cause to others to be able to blame us for anything. So even if we don't associate with evildoers, and even if we don't give opportunity for others to accuse us, we know it can happen anyway. In Luke, we have the example of that in Luke 23. In Luke 23, in verse 13. And there's the example of someone who was falsely accused. And Pilate, verse 13, and Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and the rulers of the people, said to them, you have brought this man, which is Jesus Christ, unto me as one that perverts the people. And behold, I have examined him before you and have found no fault in this man touching the things of which you accuse him. Verse 15, no, nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him, and nothing worthy of death is done to him. Jesus Christ was sinless, and yet he was falsely accused. Well, certainly if it happens to him, it can happen to us. Continuing in Matthew 26. In Matthew 26, we continue the story in verse 59. Now the priest chiefs and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death. Notice it didn't say they followed, weren't searching for witnesses. They were searching for false witnesses because they knew that the truth wasn't going to help them. So now we move on to verse 60, Matthew 26, 50. But found none. They couldn't even find false witnesses. And the reason is, let's read through the verse, yea, though many false witnesses came, yet they found none. Now let's examine that for a moment. When police take people into custody, the police separate those suspects or witnesses into different rooms and they interrogate them separately. That's when the police find out if each of the suspect stories agree with each other. And if the suspect stories aren't the same, they don't line up, then they know that one or more of the suspects are lying and further questioning might reveal who, or they can't believe any of them and they can't use them for witnesses. Well, that's what they're telling us here, but their witnesses in verse in Mark 14:56, it explains that. In Mark 14:56, we get little bits and pieces from each of the Gospels that are able to describe this time of trial of Christ when he was being falsely accused. In Mark 14, verse 56, for many bear false witness against him, meaning against Christ, but their witnesses agreed not together. Well, in other words, they were each telling a different story and the stories didn't match up. So they were falsely accusing Christ. In Matthew, Mark 14, it goes on, and there arose certain and bear false witness against him. So finally they did find, of course, two that false witnesses whose stories that they had collaborated together to make their stories agree. In Proverbs 18, in verse 17, we find how false accusers can get caught in their own lies. In Proverbs 18, verse 17, and this happens, I think, every single day in the newspaper, on the television, or on the radio, or internet news, is we see examples of this. In Proverbs 18, verse 17, he that's first in his own cause seems just, but his neighbor comes and searches him. In other words, anybody can say something, and it can sound true. But what happens when there are more questions asked and more truth is sought and the facts are put together? Then the false accusers can get caught in their lies. Well, so we can avoid, we cannot associate with evil, and we can give no opportunity for others to accuse us. What more can we do? Well, point four is that we can overcome evil with good. We can overcome evil with good. Experience teaches us that the surest way to eliminate a bad habit is to replace it with a good habit. First, we identify the offensive behavior, and then we replace it with better behavior. It sounds simple, right? Well, then why is it so hard? I know I try this myself regularly, and I know it's hard to replace a habit that we wish we didn't have, with replace it with one that we did. Many years ago, my dad read a Reader's Digest article and said, and I was a young fellow, a lad at the time, but I remember he read the article that said that the people that were married the longest, the husband always took out the garbage. And from that day forward, my dad always took out the garbage every morning. And I was puzzled. Of course, it was a rural farm life, and the life was a little different than the modern, than what we have now. And it was a couple generations ago that this occurred. And I noticed for the rest of his life, while he was physically able, he would every morning the garbage went with him when he went out of the house. And then it was later. I was talking to him, and I said, you know, it's really tough. And here I am. I was in my 40s. And I'm saying, Dad, I want to establish this new habit, and I'm trying to figure out how to do it. And I said, you know, how do you do it? He said, oh, well, it's really not that hard. He says, you just attach your new, what you want to do as a new habit, attach it to a habit you already have. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, for example, he said, I always wanted to remember to do a certain chore in the morning, he said. So I always made a point of doing it right after I took out the garbage. Because he had already had the one habit, so he attached the next habit to it. And then he was able to build the second habit. And then he would go on to build the third one. I said, Dad, you should have told me 40 years before. It would have saved me a lot of hassle. But that's what he was doing, was then overcoming a bad habit by replacing it with a good habit. Well, the point here is overcoming good with evil. In Romans 12, in verse 1, in verses 1 and 2, in Romans 12, in verses 1 and 2, Paul is writing, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service, and be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable, the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Well, that's what we're doing when we overcome evil with good. We're getting closer to the mind of God. We're making our bodies a living sacrifice. We're being holy and acceptable to God. And God expects that that's just reasonable. That's a reasonable thing that we can do. If we continue on in Romans 12, it gives us a long list of what we should do. In fact, that chapter is really phenomenal of things that we should do in the affirmative. You know, a love without dissimulation in verse 9, abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good, be kindly affectioned to one another, not slothful in business, and so forth. Down to verse 14, and then there's a really, really hard one. Bless them which persecute you, bless and curse not. It wasn't just enough to bless. The instruction was to not curse the person that's doing someone who is persecuting you. Well, both of those, frankly, are very hard. If someone is making your life difficult, it's hard to imagine forming the words in your mouth, even on your knees, and asking God to bless them. When, particularly if you're in a position like Daniel in the lion's den, and you're asking God to bless the king, or you're Joseph in the pit, being sold by his brothers, or you're Joseph in the prison in Egypt, or any of the other circumstances where a false accusation has arisen, how do you bless those who persecute you? And not just to not bless, and you say, well, I can't really bring myself to bless them. But at minimum, you are not to curse them. Don't wish any ill on them. Now, that's got to be really hard. Because I've talked to people. In fact, there was a fellow at a company I used to work for. And he said, if I ever get a terminal disease and I can still move around, he says, I got me a list that I'm going to take care of those guys. He had been saving up this list so that in the event that he should ever come to a time when he could still get around, he was going to get his vengeance. He was going to make things happen till his last breath. He was going to take care of it. Let's come down to verse 17 there in Romans 12. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. Verse 18, if it be possible, as much as lies in you, live peaceably with all men. Notice it doesn't say it is possible. It just says if it's possible. Remember, one of those other instructions here is sometimes, you know, some people are not possible. So you want to separate yourself from evil, as we've talked about earlier. So here, but if it is possible, and as much as lies within you, and some of us have a greater degree of ability to tolerate wrong things around us, and some have a lesser ability to live peaceably. Verse 19, dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it's written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. I work with, over the years, with a lot of distressed fathers, and I think of them particularly now as Father's Day is upon us, and many of them have been wronged with false accusations, and it's very hard for them to put away the vengeance mindset. But those that I've worked with in the church have a better understanding of the truth, and they know that someday the false accuser will stand before Jesus Christ in the judgment throne. And that person will have to answer for that. They don't have to answer to me or to anybody else. They have to answer before the throne of God. And so vengeance is mine. I will repay. God will take care of those things. And so we move on to verse 20. Therefore, if your enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, you shall heap coals of fire on his head. And I'm going to cover that one in particular in another message. But verse 21, and this is point 4 reiterated right here. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. So doing that which is prescribed in Romans is probably some of the most difficult things that humans can do. Dealing righteously with those who would do harm to us. The Apostle Peter wrote in 1 Peter 3:8. The Apostle Peter wrote in verse 3 and verse 8. We're starting in verse 8. Finally, be you of all one mind, having compassion one of another. Love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous, not rendering evil for evil, or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, knowing that you are called, that you should inherit a blessing. For he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil, and his lips that speak no guile. You don't have to plan on verbally beating up the people that are doing you wrong. They will bring enough evil on themselves, just as we read about the rock rolling back on someone, if they wish to roll it on you. Verse 11, let him eschew evil. In other words, put it away. And do good. Let him seek peace and ensue it or pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers. But the face of the Eternal is against them that do evil. Those are the people that have the troubles. They have the real problems. They've got to face God face to face. It says the face of God is against them that do evil. I would hope that that would not be said of me, that the face is against the Eternal, because I did something that I shouldn't. Verse 14, but if you will suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are you, and be not afraid of their terror, neither be troubled. In other words, don't be afraid of the people who will do you evil, because if you for suffering for righteousness' sake. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts. Be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks you of the reason of the hope that's within you with meekness and fear. Verse 17, for it is better if the will of God be so that you suffer for well-doing than for evil-doing. I mean, anybody can suffer for evil-doing. I mean, we're all subject to that. You go down here and rob the post office and you'll have the federales on your case real quick, like, and you will suffer and you'll get and you'll have all kinds of trouble. That's to be expected, any crime. But what about the will of God? It's better if the will of God, if we're following God's will and somebody tries to make us suffer for doing good, for well-doing, that God expects us to do well and ultimately will reward us accordingly. Notice that Peter is referring to suffering for righteousness' sake, suffering for well-doing. You know, I heard a story, it was many years ago, about a little boy was walking on the sidewalk in Australia with his dad. And there was a man that came along on this coming down the street, and he had in his forehead a big nasty scar, but it was the letter S and the letter T was right on his forehead. And the little boy said to his dad, now, what is that ST for? Well, what the little boy didn't know and what the father didn't know is that the man down the street, an old man, had a long history and lived a long life. And in Australia, they were populated with thieves and other criminals that were emptied out of the prisons in England and sent on ships to populate Australia. And there were no jails in Australia. because they were all criminals of some sort. So they had no real way to deal with thieves other than to mark them. And this particular man happened, as a young man, committed crimes in Australia, and that crime was stealing sheep. So when he was caught and convicted, they put a brand on his forehead for ST, meaning sheep thief, and everybody would watch out for him. And it was now 2 generations later, and the old man was walking down the street. And the little boy was hand in hand with his father, and the little boy asked him what the ST meant. And the father, having known the old man for many years, but not knowing the story behind the brand, said, "Well, he's been such an honorable and a good man. The only thing I can think of is that the ST must mean saint." And so the old man lived his life, despite his earlier mistakes, in a way that he would allow the good in his life to overcome the evil. Point number 5, be prepared to forgive. Be prepared to forgive. In Mark 11, verse 24, "Therefore, I say to you, whatsoever you desire when you pray, believe that you will receive them, and you shall have them." Verse 25, "And when you stand praying, forgive, if you have aught against any, that your Father also, which is in heaven, may forgive you your trespasses. But if you do not forgive, neither will your Father, which is in heaven, forgive your trespasses." That's pretty striking, and it's pretty hard. But we have to be prepared and willing to forgive when the opportunity presents itself for those who are willing to sin against us. Point number 6, know that the truth will set you free. Point 6, know that the truth will set you free. Now, this isn't simply a trite saying that is overused by certain religious types, or we hear about it on movies or on the news and a protest. Let's turn to John in chapter 8 and verse 32. In John 8:32, this is where the saying comes from, "The truth shall set you free." "And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Well, truth of what? Truth of the knowledge of God, and to understand the destiny of mankind, that we serve a God who has a plan of salvation for mankind. This knowledge frees us from the enslavement to a lie. With the knowledge that we have of the truths of God, we're free from the false teachings of mankind. However, in this life, we still have to deal with the false accuser. Let's take a look back at Proverbs 11 in verse 9. In Proverbs 11 in verse 9, "A hypocrite with his mouth destroys his neighbor." Well, we've certainly seen that. Maybe we've had a touch of it, where somebody's tried to destroy us, or our reputation, or our lives are altered in some way by the hypocrite. But what is the rest of that verse? "But through knowledge shall the just be delivered." God is going to take care of those who do well and follow God's law. Knowledge of what? Knowledge of God's law. And it says just, which means you have to perform it. You have to do it. We're already in Proverbs. Let's look at Proverbs 18 and verse 17. We've read that before. "He that's first in his own cause seems just, but his neighbor comes and searches him out." In this sense, then, the truth will set us free. We may have heard of the expression, "Well, if the truth be known," fill in the blank, you know, "then the outcome would be different." So, in our lives, it's important that the truth be known. We read earlier in 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1, that you know always, that this know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. "For men shall be lovers of themselves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good." And we read similarly in 2 Peter 2, 1, a similar verse in 2 Peter 2, 1 about false accusers. But there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you. Ooh, that sounds terrible. So, second in Peter, they're telling us there were false prophets, and there are false teachers. And then what do they do? Who privately shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that brought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. It doesn't mean that the destruction will come immediately upon them, right, as they say, as you've heard the expression, you know, well, lightning didn't strike him down. No, it's when the destruction does come, it will come quickly. And in 2 Peter 2, and then we follow up in verse 2, and does it say only a few people are going to be tricked by these false prophets and false teachers? Verse 2, it says, and many shall follow their pernicious ways, means poisonous, by reason of the way of truth, evil shall be spoken of. Well, so they're trying to turn the truth into a lie, and the lie into a truth. So, knowing that truth will set us free. But does that mean that we just have to stand there and say, well, I know the truth, nothing's going to happen to me? We have an instruction on that in Matthew 10. In Matthew 10, there is some instruction on what to do and what's going to happen in the end times. Starting in verse 18 in Matthew 10, and you shall be brought before governors and kings for my sake, Christ is speaking here, for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, take no thought how or what you shall speak, for it shall be given you in that same hour what you shall speak. For it is not that you speak, but the Spirit of your Father which speaks in you. And the brother shall deliver up brother to death. We're speaking of that end time. In other words, other people will rat each other out. The father and the child, the children shall rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you, meaning the believers, will be hated of all men for my name's sake. But he that endures to the end shall be saved. But does it say that you should just sit in one spot and wait for lightning to strike or people to do bad things? Verse 23, but when they persecute you in this city, flee to another. For I say to you, you shall not have gone over all the cities of Israel till the Son of Man be come. In other words, you don't want to sit still if you have an opportunity to do what? To avoid the evil. So do the best opportunity you can is to avoid the evil. We can have confidence that what God says is true. In 1 John 2, in verse 4, he says, I know him and keep not his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. So the ninth commandment about bearing false witness is about our lives. That if we say we know God and we do not keep God's commandments, what is this telling us? That means that the truth is not in us. And that should strike all of us, that we must be careful on a daily basis to keep the commandments laid out by God, because we would not want to be thought in God's eyes as to be a liar. We're already in 1 John 2. Let's go down to verse 22. Who is a liar but he that denies that Jesus is the Christ? He is Antichrist, or against Christ, that denies the Father and the Son. So we know that God is true, and we know how to identify a liar, those that do not, or that throw over the belief in Christ. In Revelation 21, verse 8, and this is one of those scripture card ones that you'll come across in your scripture book, and I remember this from many years ago, from a friend who's an elder up in the Minneapolis area. And he had this one down because I'd mentioned something in a joke one time. Only he was calling me on it, and he immediately pulls Revelation 21:8 out and says, but the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and the murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. So he was warning me to be careful on my jokes that I was telling. So that one is know that the truth of God will set you free. And then point 7 is our hope. What is our hope? And we read that in the last two verses here, in 1 Peter 2 and verse 9. It tells us about our hope. But you, 1 Peter 2:9, but you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. God has given us an opportunity to be that chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar or unusual people. That we are called into the light, the truth of God. Remember that it was point six, that truth will free us from the burdens of sin. And finally, Jeremiah 17:7. About our hope, in Jeremiah 17:7-8. Blessed is the man that trusts in the Lord, and whose hope the Lord is. For he shall be as a tree planted by the waters, and that spreads out her roots by the river, and shall not see when the heat comes, or her leaf shall be green, and shall not be careful in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit. Because when we're close to God, we're close to the Holy Spirit, which is pictured as water, being watering, planted by a tree, that we're a tree planted by the waters. And that we'll always have that water, we'll always have that life spirit of God's given to us. And so that we take good use of that and shall cease from yielding, so that we'll never cease from yielding fruit. So what can we do about the ninth commandment when we have to deal with false accusations? We can be patient with those who sin against us. We should not associate evil with evil. Number three, we should give no opportunity for others to accuse us. Four, we should overcome evil with good. Five, we should be prepared to forgive. Six, we know that the truth will set us free, free from slavery to sin. And seven, we should know our great hope. And that great hope is ever before us.